are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. It often seems in times like these that social activism, radical activism, is not very rewarding. Chances for success of, say, a radical left proposal or program aren't very high in the prevailing political climate, and clear-cut victories can be few and far between. So then, what happens? Well, some activists get burned out, some get depressed, some may feel no small amount of despair coming on. Hopefully your experience has been different. The point is, one's mental and emotional well-being may be significantly affected by one's activist ambitions and by the extent to which those ambitions are or are not realized. Today we'll talk about issues like these and about the ability of psychology as a discipline to address these kinds of issues with Terry Coopers. Terry is a psychiatrist in private practice in the Bay Area, as well as a faculty member at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. He's also a longtime prisoner rights activist and the author of books like Ending Therapy, Revisioning Men's Lives, and Prison Madness. Terry joins me in our studios in Berkeley. Welcome to you.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you here. Terry, I want to start with some personal history. I know you were first attracted to psychoanalysis, to learning about how to do psychoanalysis, because of what you saw as its potential for social liberation. I'm reading here from something you wrote. What kind of potential are you referring to here?
Well, an in-depth study of our own psyche, of what's going on in our heads, is a way to see through the current social reality as it's presented, for instance, consumerism. And really, the way to struggle against consumerism and the way it controls our life is to understand ourselves more and more deeply, which the psychoanalytic project attempted to do. There was, in the early days of psychoanalysis, a strong revolutionary thrust among the psychoanalysts in Europe. Of course, when they came to the United States, they became more narrowly clinical. But at the time, we had people like Wilhelm Reich, we had Otto Fenichel, we had the Frankfurt School in Germany, where they were using psychoanalytic theory to analyze how capitalism was able to survive when there should have been, according to all the historical projections, there should have been revolutions in Europe. Instead, capitalism survived. How? Had a lot to do with imperialism, with consumerism, and it had to do with how the system was able to control people's minds to make them relatively happy buying things instead of turning and saying, what's wrong with our system and we need to change it? So psychoanalysis then became a double-edged project. On the one hand, we could use it to analyze what's wrong with people's psychological life under capitalism. On the other hand, capitalism used it. Psychoanalysts were involved in designing consumerism and talking about how ads could manipulate people's minds to buy and be happy.
Well, as you talk about these thinkers and psychoanalysts in Europe who came over to the U.S. and, as you said, might have become less political when they arrived, a lot of these people read Marx, read Karl Marx, thought about Karl Marx. It obviously influenced their critiques of capitalism. You became a Marxist in the 1960s, and this is another important part of your story and the story we'll talk about today. Why did you become a Marxist then?
Well, if I had to name a moment, I would say it was the civil rights movement. I had gotten active. I had been influenced in college by Robert McAfee Brown, who was very involved in social struggles and civil rights movements. And I got involved with the farm workers, organizing and tutoring young migrant farm workers in California. Then I went south for the civil rights movement. It was at the time when SNCC was becoming very militant, and there were statements like Stokely Carmichael's Hunky Go Home. And a lot of radicals, white radicals, left in disgust. Theodore Bekele were removed, pulled back his money he'd been contributing, saying that the black movement is anti-Semitic. I didn't think that was the case, but I was totally confused. And I came back to California, and it's the Marxists who explained to me what was happening, the need for people of color to lead their own movement, the need for white people to organize their own, how it all fit with a social analysis, with the national liberation struggle. So it started to make sense, and then I got very interested in Marxism. If they could make sense of it for me, there must be something here. As I started studying Marxism, I started running across the Frankfurt School, Herbert Marcuse, that kind of thing, and it gave me a tool for analyzing, a tool that's very similar to psychoanalysis. Marxism and psychoanalysis share a lot in terms of methodology. For instance, both fields assume that the appearance that we experience is not the truth, that there's something deeper underlying it. For Freud, it was in the unconscious. For Marx, it was the ideological distortion to support capitalism. Both fields require struggle, active struggle, in order to know. That is, your knowledge comes from the struggle. In psychoanalysis, it's doing your clinical practice. In Marxism, it's struggling to change the world. And both assume that the experimenter is part of the experiment. That is, for the Marxist, we each have our own class interests, and we have to be very careful in all of our ventures, our social struggles and our scientific statements. We have to make sure that we control for our own bias that comes from our class, racial, ethnic position. And in psychoanalysis, of course, there's the transference and countertransference, and it's the same kind of study of self as the experimenter who's part of the experiment, and we have to control our own biases.
Could you define transference and countertransference very briefly for us?
Well, in the broadest sense, transference is the feelings a patient has about their therapist, Sands, about their psychoanalyst. In a more narrow sense, it's the distortion in that relationship that's caused by previous relationships, for instance, relationships with parents. Countertransference is the equivalent feeling in the other direction, what the analyst or therapist feels towards the client, which is a distortion based on their previous experience.
You mentioned Herbert Marcuse, an enormously influential thinker and someone who, in the 1960s, many people looked to for sources of kind of revolutionary ideas, ideas about liberation, social liberation. And one thing Marcuse did, and that you became very interested in, was to look at Marx and Freud and to maybe not synthesize them, but to reconcile them in certain ways. Was his project and was your interest in Marx and Freud, was it based on what you just mentioned about there being certain similarities between the two lines of thought, or was there more to it?
Well, it was that, and there was more to it. That is, there was something about the methodologies that was similar, and therefore there was something compatible about a combined approach of Marxism and psychoanalysis. But the other thing is the problems we were dealing with. Now, I wasn't alive then, but the Frankfurt School began in the 1920s, and the problem they were having was that they saw the problems of Stalinism very early. And so what they wanted to do, these were very sophisticated Marxists, Horkheimer, Adorno, Marcuse was a little younger, and what they wanted to do was save Marxism from the Soviets, that is to develop a very sophisticated version of Marxism that doesn't rely on the Soviet Union being right, because on a lot of questions they thought they weren't right. So they used psychoanalysis in that project. And then they had another battle to confront, and that was about capitalism and how it had morphed itself in the 20th century so that it wasn't subject to revolution. How did that happen? And they felt that the battle was really in psychology, that it was a battle for the citizen's mind, and where Henry Ford and the consumerist development wanted to manipulate people into buying things and being happy from buying rather than organizing a union and protesting. The sophisticated Marxists wanted to use the same way of thinking, the same psychoanalytic principles, and understand why it was that people were loyal to capitalism, or in the Second World War, Nevitt Sanford, who is the founder of the school I teach at, the Wright Institute, wrote The Authoritarian Personality with Theodore Adorno, one of the members of the Frankfurt School. And what they wanted to know was, why are people in Germany amenable to Nazism? Why do they become Nazis? And they looked at the family structure and authoritarianism in the family. So there was the use of psychoanalytic method to understand large social phenomena.
It's interesting because as you talk about this sort of social and political analysis, a lot of people would say, well, what I think of when I think of psychoanalysis is somebody in a couch and somebody sitting there and going through Oedipal complex conflicts and all kinds of internal processes involving or being traced back to one's childhood, for example, and one's relationship with one's family. And so then, can you give us a concrete example of how these radical therapists, and maybe radical therapists such as yourselves, closer to the present, might integrate social concerns, a sort of political vision of the world, into what they're doing in this room with their client?
Well, that's a very good question. Really, there is no therapy that occurs in isolation from what's going on socially. What tends to happen, what's happened to psychoanalysis as it's moved to the United States, it's become more conservative, and the social aspect of the analysis has dropped out. Russell Jacoby wrote a book about that, about Otto Fenichel, who was a socialist in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, came to the United States and became a narrow clinician. He never wrote another word about society, and he wrote only about psychopathology and how to do analysis. There's always a context in which we choose what to talk about. Therapy is basically a conservative practice. That is, its aim is to help people function better in the world as it is. And that makes it conservative. That is, what it makes people is a better worker. So that currently lawyers or corporate executives come to see therapists and say, I'm not able to be productive enough at work, or I'm not able to put on a happy face for my superiors and my colleagues. And so something's wrong with me, fix it. And the reason to fix it is to work better, not to look at what are your goals, why are you working 12 hours a day in corporate law or in the corporations. And so there's always a choice. When I was a young adult, we were accused, radicals were accused, and particularly me, because I was a young radical in the psychiatric field, so I was in training, I was accused of acting out my Oedipal rebellion. That is, I was a social activist because I had not resolved my conflicts with my father, and I had authority issues. Bruno Bettelheim said it, that all student revolutionaries are acting out infantile tantrums. And Louis Feuer, a social scientist on the UC Berkeley campus, said that Mario Savio, one of the leaders of the free speech movement, was acting out his Oedipal complex. Well, that was an interesting question. Later, many years later, I look back on that and I say, well, I did have some issues with authority. I also had a well-grounded critique of capitalism, and I had a sense of what was wrong. I didn't like racism. I didn't like the war in Vietnam. I didn't like sexism, and I wanted to struggle to change it. I felt it was my social responsibility to do that. But then becomes the issue, well, who is distorting reality then? The therapist who says I'm acting out my Oedipal complex and is himself not active in correcting what even he has to admit is wrong with society? Or am I the one suffering psychopathology because I want to act to correct what I see as wrong in psychology? So there's always that bias in the therapeutic stance. That is, what do you choose to analyze? Do you choose to analyze activism, which my therapists and analysts chose to act to interpret in me as pathology?
Right.
Or do you choose to interpret the inactivism of the majority of people? So in a conservative approach to therapy, what you do is the inactive person is the norm, the active person is abnormal, and therefore we analyze what's wrong with the person who chooses to be active. My own view is that activists need to look at their own psychological life and what authority conflicts they might have, but that doesn't dismiss the fact that they have a legitimate social analysis that says something's wrong and needs to be corrected.
Terry Kupers, K-U-P-E-R-S, joins us in studio on Against the Grain. He is a faculty member at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, longtime prisoner rights activist, an expert in the areas of mental health in prisons, prison conditions as human rights concerns, and prison rape. He's also a board-certified psychiatrist with a private practice in the Bay Area. Now, I imagine that some folks might accuse therapists who bring their own political visions into the counseling room and, in addition, talk about certain social or political concerns, maybe even about the status quo under which their clients are laboring, under their clients are trying to, you know, adapt to and work under, and say, well, isn't there a danger that this kind of therapist might, however subtly, politically indoctrinate the client? What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's true. And I think we have to avoid political indoctrination. Therapy is basically a concentrated effort to listen very closely to what an individual's concerns are, and that individual is the client or the patient. So when the therapist's concerns become the dominant part of the therapy, something wrong is going on. However, I don't agree with the idea that the radical therapist is bringing social concerns into the therapy. Actually, what I think is that all therapy has a social aspect to it, and there's a choice to ignore it or to deal with it. The choice to ignore it, that is the choice to say, look, your unhappiness at work has to do with your psychopathological depression or your issues about your unresolved conflicts with parents, that's a choice. Another way you could say it is, well, what's going on at the workplace is really unfair. It really has to do with capitalism and the way profits are being distributed. It really has to do with the way plants are being downsized, the way laborers are being ripped off. And we need to understand your sense of non-accomplishment in that social context. Now, it's not that the therapist who does that is indoctrinating the client. He might be. The question is, whose issues is he listening to? But my point would be that the therapist who doesn't look at that level of analysis is indoctrinating the client. Indoctrinating the client without saying so to look only within for the source of his unhappiness.
This brings to mind for me this question of emotional or mental norms, this idea of who is a healthy person, who is psychologically normal, who is insane, for example, on the other extreme. And what you seem to be suggesting is that these norms must be socially constructed. And of course, well, you've written about this. To talk more about that, to the extent to which society really imposes these norms, to which many therapists no doubt blindly follow.
Yes, and I don't know any other way for norms to be constructed than socially. Of course, the norms is what we socially accept as normal. I think it's actually a very bad way to guide psychotherapy or any kind of social service intervention. That is to try to get people to be normal. There's something very abnormal to me about that. Let me give an example. I think that if therapy is conservative, as I just explained, psychopathology, the theory of the different kinds of mental illnesses, is even more conservative or reactionary.
Mm.
For instance, we have a history of pathologizing homosexuality. In the early 70s, there was a diagnosis, homosexuality, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the American Psychiatric Association's list of diagnoses. It was removed because of gay liberation struggles, that is, people protested. There was a diagnosis proposed of the sort of woman as victim, the woman who tends to get victimized, and, for instance, the survivor of domestic violence. Now, why is it that we weren't pathologizing the perpetrator of domestic violence? Why don't we pathologize homophobia? Why don't we have a category of homophobia? We don't. In the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. That's a social bias, so there's no way not to have a social bias. I have an entirely different version of psychopathology, and it's this. I'm not opposed to a psychopathology. I just think the one we have is extremely reactionary. I would propose this, and that is that the entire social justice project, the revolutionary, the radical struggle, is about envisioning a better society and then struggling to enact that better society here where we live. Well, what if we took as our psychopathology, our theory of psychopathology, what are the qualities in people that would work in that better society?
Hmm.
So rather, what's wrong with the person who is homosexual or who is the woman who in the 20s and 30s, women who were ambitious and went out and sought employment among the men were considered to be acting out their castration complex. So you pathologize what is sort of not the norm of the time, and that changes over time. What if what we pathologized are the things that wouldn't work in the society we envision? So we envision gender equity. We envision an end to racism. We envision an end to the massive maldistribution of wealth. And what if we and homophobia would be pathology. What if we pathologize those things? What if we say that excessive ambition, selfishness, homophobia, misogyny are the forms of mental illness, and then I aim our therapy at correcting those forms so that as we do therapy, we're working towards the society we envision. That would be my proposal for a psychopathology. I believe that was the project of radical therapy, and that was the project of the 60s, not even the therapists, but of the 60s, which is to envision the society that we would prefer and then struggle as hard as we can to make that happen.
And in answer to your what-if questions, I would probably say, well, in that case, psychology and psychiatry would become radical challenges to the status quo, the social and political status quos. And then in this political climate that we're in now, it's hard to imagine any establishment, let alone, say, the therapy establishment, allowing that to happen.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And the therapy establishment is a vested interest that's very deeply committed to their way of making a living and making profits. But let me give you an example of an instance where that occurred. Of course, this Wilhelm Reich's work and his work on sexuality was very profound and relevant today. There's Herbert Marcuse's work. Otto Fenichel was a psychoanalyst who was a socialist in the 20s and 30s. I don't know how close he was to the Communist Party, but he wrote an article in the 1920s, The Need to Amass Wealth, and it's an article in the Psychoanalytic Journal. And what he said is, he is arguing with Freud. Freud is saying, if you lack ambition, sufficient ambition to get ahead in your chosen career or work area, then you're hung up on the Oedipal complex. You're afraid of castration by your father, or you have a success phobia or something like that. And Otto Fenichel said, what if that's not true? What if it's the opposite? What if what we're doing is honing too much ambition and we're making people neurotic by making them think, for instance, in the East Bay, they have to have a home in the hills, or they have to have a job which brings them a certain amount of income, or they have to drive a Lexus? What if we're creating false standards to aims that we need to achieve, and then making a lot of people miserable who aren't achieving it? Then he went on to say, and this was his Marxist analysis, now why are we doing that? And he pointed to Marx's view of capital and the way in which under capitalism there needs to be an accelerating rate of profit. That is, making the same amount of profit you made last year will not keep you solvent in today's capitalism. In fact, you'll get bought out by a bigger corporation. So what you have to do is constantly accelerate the rate of profit, which drives you to reduce wages, to break unions, to go overseas, to have your labor done. And he says, well, now, what if that's a bad system? And we don't want that system. Why are we modeling our psychopathology and our psychotherapy on that system so that the ambition where we feel a need to continually accumulate and accomplish more is based on the capitalist model of the need for an accelerating rate of profit? What if we just stopped that and said, what's wrong with living in the house you've been living in for 10 years? What's wrong with driving a less prestigious car?
Terry Coopers joins us in studio on Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. He teaches at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. We have links on againstthegrain.org to at least, I think, a couple of his books, and they include Ending Therapy, The Meaning of Termination, Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars and What We Must Do About It, and Revisioning Men's Lives, Gender, Intimacy, and Power. And when I think about sort of the struggle to create a more socially just world, and you were talking about your early activism being psychopathologized by people who were dealing with you, who were supervising you, for example, in a residency, I don't think you mentioned this, that you were doing in psychiatry in the Watts District in Los Angeles. There's a kind of ambition that activists have, right? They are working toward a better world. They want their projects, their proposals to work out, to be realized in their communities, in their cities, in the wider world. And you have written about the sort of differing contexts in which, say, activists in the 60s and, say, activists today operate. There is a very different political climate. The possibilities, as I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, seem to be a lot fewer in the current climate. So I'm wondering what you have found out in terms of ambitions, the necessity or the requirement that these ambitions be realized in order to feel satisfied, and what we can say, it's a big question, about maybe how this operates among or between the two generations.
Well, we can use psychology two ways. As I've been speaking, I've been correcting what I think is wrong with psychology. I think psychology today, establishment psychology, is basically conservative. However, it can be corrected. We can look, for instance, towards a vision of the future rather than towards the past in defining what's psychopathological. We can then use that corrected psychology to look at two things. One is the psychology of our times, that is, what the mass culture puts forward as the psychological life. What is consumerism about? Why are people interested in driving that Lexus? We can also turn that inward to the activist. When we turn it into the activist, something is very obvious, and I'm very impressed by this, and I'm glad that I was born when I was born. And that is, in the 60s, something happened. I believe it happened in the 30s as well, and this is what happened. A generation of people came of age at a time when they believed, for whatever reasons, and the reasons are complicated, that the world could be better and that they could envision how the world would be better. That was the revolutionary project, or even the hippie project, the youth project. The world could be better. They could envision how the world would be better. And if they could work hard enough at envisioning it and argue their differences and study Marx and do what they could to figure out how to do things better, whether it was men and women getting along in some kind of equitable basis, ending racism, giving workers a break, ending pollution and doing something about the environment, stopping war, all of these things could be envisioned. When they were envisioned, we could put ourselves firmly in the struggle to make the better world happen, and that would then lead us to a better life. That was a worldview. It was also a psychology. So you have a generation of people growing up feeling that. Richard Flax, the sociologist at Santa Barbara, has said that your consciousness for a lifetime is the consciousness that you came into adulthood with. So people listen to the rock music of their late teens and early 20s still. Well, the 60s radicals have this view that they can change the world in their image, and their image is going to be worked out collectively with all the other radicals, and then the world is going to be better. A lot of them have retired from the active struggles by this time. However, they still have that mindset in their background. People who came of age in the 70s and 80s and the 90s in particular don't have that that perception. Therefore, they're more focused on present concerns, for instance, how much income they can make, what their position is, what their power is, what pleasures they can buy. And that's a very different mindset. Now, for the radical who came of age in the 60s, by the way, I think there's a reemergence of the 60s consciousness today. Mm. I see it all around. It's very hopeful, and that is there are young people in motion. I see it. I'm active in the prison movement. We have a lot of young activists in the prison movement. They're not literally, but at least symbolically, in a lot of cases literally, they're the children of the 60s. They're the children of people who had that mindset in the 60s and conveyed it to their children. Now, what happens, I believe, when radicals get into trouble or ex-radicals get in trouble and get depressed, for instance, about not achieving enough in their life, they're buying into the complacent conservative psychology of the times. That is, you buy things in order to be happy, and the more you buy, the happier you are. If you can't afford to buy enough, then you're a lesser person. So because they don't have the radical movements to support their earlier mindset, they fall into that trap. And in fact, what they need is to be reminded of that project, that the world could be a better place. That, for instance, staying home, a man staying home and helping to raise the children so his wife could be out doing a career like him, and therefore he isn't going to advance as far or as fast. That was something that was supported by the movements of the 60s. It's less supported today, and that's unfortunate. But we have to be reminded that that was possible and that it's still worth struggling for.
We're going to get to a case study that illustrates some of these points. Terry Cooper joins us on Against the Grain. We'll take a short music break and talk about a lot more and a lot of interest to people interested in mental health and radical activism and into a broader project that involves social justice concerns. Please stay with us. We have links to resources relating to today's show with Terry Cooper on our website, againstthegrain.org, where you can also go to download podcasts.